Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you for tuning in today to the online health classes from EnsHealthSpace.com. My name is Ann Elliott. Today on Ann's Health Class, we're going to learn easy steps of food preparation that have been followed for thousands of years since the creation of the world itself, or at least since the time of Noah and his son. Words like lactofermentation and wild fermentation, we're going to introduce these words and explain it all in easy terms today. They sound hard, but they are not. In fact, we are going to learn that ancient methods of food preparation were not only easy, they also taste fabulous. We're going to discover how to excel at cooking and how to enjoy it and how to make it taste great. This is going to be a really practical session. Okay, once again, I have my friend Kathy with me today. Now, Kathy's just pulling into town after a trip down to Texas where she visited her daughter at college for the weekend. So it was quite a sacrifice for her to be with us today, and I'm so glad she's here. Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Hi, Ann. I'm wonderful, and it was no sacrifice. It's that we had an amazing time, and we loved it down there. It's springtime down there. I mean, the trees were budding. Oh, and the grass was green, and it was cool in the morning, but it warmed up. It was gorgeous. But, of course, I am glad to be home, and I'll talk more about it probably throughout the show. You probably won't be able to shut me up. But anyway, I am so glad to be here today, Ann.
Oh, thank you. Well, Kathy, I just got done saying that we're going to learn two easy steps for food preparation that have been followed for thousands of years since the creation of the world itself, or at least since the time of Noah and his sons. Now, does that seem like an outlandish statement to you, Kathy?
Wow, for thousands of years, yes. I mean, it does. When you think about it, you know, I guess it's probably pride, but we think we have really advanced over the years and that we're probably doing things pretty good now. But, I know differently. And I'm anxious to hear about these two steps for food preparation.
Well, it's so cool. My children are in the middle of a unit study on Egypt, and we are learning so much. Each child has things which interest him or her, of course, and they tend to study a little bit more about those things on their own time, but Mom loves reading about nutrition, so I've been paying close attention to what scientists have discovered about nutrition in ancient Egypt, and of course, this was a heathen nation. They were very pagan, followed the idols of the nations around them, and amazingly, I found that those Egyptians suffered from similar degenerative diseases that we face here today in developed nations here in America. But even more fun, this is to me anyway, the fun thing is that the weeks earlier this year, we dove into the earliest civilizations of time, and we studied Noah. I was so interested in the story of Noah and his drunkenness. This is not the famous part of Noah, but he got drunk when he planted a vineyard after he came off the ark. But to me, I'm saying, ooh, nutrition, that's just one more proof. And it's in a long line of evidences that foods have been lacto-fermented since at least the time of Noah. I mean, where did he even learn to cultivate grapes and wine? And surely he didn't just stumble on it by chance in the first year after the devastation of a worldwide flood. I wouldn't even be able to grow anything in that kind of an environment. It makes me wonder what the ancient peoples, those who lived before the flood, what they knew and what they had developed. What kinds of foods did they eat? Especially considering the fact that God allowed them almost 1,000-year lifespans. What were their secrets? And what culinary skills did Mrs. Noah have at the ripe old age of 600 years old? What did her daughters-in-law, obviously several hundred years old each themselves, what did they teach to their children and to their descendants after the flood? Obviously, the fermentation of wine was part of their expertise. Mm-hmm. In Job 12:12, and we have this verse at the top of your handout today because it's so important, Job states that with the ancient is wisdom, and in length of days, understanding. And if you learn nothing else from today's class, I hope you will grasp the concept that maybe we're not the smartest people to have ever lived on the face of the earth, and maybe we don't have a monopoly on scientific knowledge in the 21st century, and that maybe there is wisdom to be gained from turning to ancient methods and secrets. Now, I am fascinated by history and science, much more so now that I'm out of school myself and I don't have to be tested every week in class. But today we're going to look at just a handful of the secrets of the ancients. So first, as you'll see on your handout, that if since ancient times, people ate food that was available to them locally. Now, Kathy, I don't believe in evolution. You probably figured that out by now.
Me neither.
I firmly believe the Bible's literal account of history, which doesn't allow for a world that is much older than 6,000 years. So I don't believe we came from cavemen who slowly increased in mental intelligence until they could grunt and groan and eke fire out of sticks. And I don't put much stock in the popular paleo diets that you're going to see at bookstores. They say that we can't do anything but hunt and gather. I believe that the first people God created were the smartest people. They were the most intelligent, the most creative of all of the people he created. And because of the devastation of sin in our hearts, we are only deteriorating in creativity and abilities. So that said, the Bible is clear that early man cultivated the fields. Agriculture was the occupation of Adam and of Cain. He's the very first son born to Adam. Livestock production was the occupation of Adam's second son. And shortly after in the book of Genesis, it tells us plainly that they were builders of cities and workers of metal and musicians. These were amazingly civilized people. Now, our records of that time were mostly destroyed by the flood. And we can see evidence of cave dwellers and primitive people groups desperately trying to survive in a very different environment after the flood. Before the flood, the temperatures were moderate and the climate was kind. But after the flood, we see the emergence of four seasons of weather, ice ages, storms that were so severe that God had to reassure them that he would never again send them a worldwide flood. So how did the first created men and women eat? How did our post-flood ancestors eat? Well, obviously, we've learned that before the flood, all humans were vegetarians. And after the flood, God in his wisdom knew that the climate had changed, and he provided animals for our nourishment as well. Hunting was not merely for clothing and sacrifices anymore. Rather, mankind ate the animals that they hunted. And this is why we see records of primitive post-flood people learning to hunt for food. It's a new thing in history, something that would not have existed before the flood. Now, the harsher and colder the climate, the more animals we see were eaten. History tells us this very plainly, because it's difficult to eat coconut milk in Alaska, obviously. It's hard to grow lush crops in Norway. Rather, the descendants of Ham and Shem and Japheth, who settled all around the world and settled in the northern countries, let's say, they ate more food and wild animals with a lower ratio of fresh and raw vegetables. But in the moderate climates of Palestine, cattle and other livestock were raised for food. And then as you go closer to the equator, more of a vegetarian diet was consumed, but not entirely. So we can discover all of this from archaeology. It's just really fun if you like getting into that sort of thing.
Wow, so, that is really interesting.
Now, our genetics, mine and yours, Kathy, and everyone that's listening, we're influenced by our ancestors, by our own unique ancestors. And it intrigues me that a food that I love might be someone else's poison. I'm sure you've heard that before. So when I say that you should eat food that is available to you locally, I believe you should take into account what would have been local to your ancestors. Maybe you descended from Ham or Shem or Japheth, and you can find that out very easily. And this will guide you in your decisions. You know, 500 years ago, did your relatives live near Africa, or did they live in Asia, or did they live in Northern Europe? And just think about, as you make decisions, what they would have eaten. Now, I apologize to everyone. If you download recipes and tips from Ann's Health Place and they seem to favor European foods and flavors, well, honestly, that's my Scandinavian heritage coming out. I'm blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and I like that kind of food. But praise God for the Internet. You can Google any kind of food in a moment worldwide and find a recipe that suits your tastes and your heritage. So, as the handout says, rather than simply heading out to your local grocery store each week, like we did in our class last week, Kathy, and we had a terrible time finding good
food. Yes, we did. We did.
It was awful. But I invite you to head out into your local landscape, including the Internet, for foods from your distant past, and find food that is close to how God created it, food that remembers it used to live in a garden or it used to be on a family farm. Now, ask yourself 5 questions about the food you consume. I've been saying these to myself for quite a few years now, so I can say them pretty fast. It's right across the top of your handout. Can you grow it? Can you hunt it? Can you pick it? Can you gather it? Can you milk it? And you just say those to yourself as you look at food. For instance, if I go to the grocery store and I look at a box of Pop-Tarts, I have to honestly say that, no, I could not grow those, hunt those, pick those, gather those, milk those. I couldn't even do that if I had the bare ingredients, because some of those ingredients were manufactured in a factory in New Jersey. But the best thing is that while I cannot make an exact replica of Pop-Tarts at home in my own kitchen, I'm positive that I can make food that tastes so good, my family will never want to go back to Pop-Tarts again. Isn't that cool?
That is cool. But it sounds like we all need to really be living on farms in order to do all this.
Oh, good point, Kathy. Good point. I am not telling you to grow it, hunt it, pick it, gather it, or milk it. That is so important to realize. I know that many of the moms in my audience are just that. They're busy moms. Maybe like me, you live inside city limits, and you cannot grow a large garden or hunt for deer or pick apples off a tree that don't even exist in your suburb that's 10 years old, or gather eggs from free-range chickens or milk a cow. I'm not allowed to do those things in city limits. So I have my days I wish I could do those things. They sound so domestic, and I'm not very domestic, but I'm also smart enough to know that we're not all called to do the same things in life, and I can't compare myself with all of the women around me. However, I can support local farmers, local farmers markets, local families, those who have a passion for chickens or grass-fed beef or organic or sustainable produce. I can support them and make new friends all along the way. Some of my closest friends have been found at a farm where I buy my raw milk, for instance. You know them, Kathy. Or at the house where eggs are, they're just pulled out of a real person's refrigerator, pulled out of a chicken. I don't even know how to talk the right lingo. You know, I don't know anything about chickens. But they're just real food from real friends. Or maybe a kind man in my church who brings me some deer meat that he shot over the weekend. Can't get much more free range than that. In the meantime, I have different gifts and talents and passions with which I can bless them. We're a community, a village, if you want to borrow Hillary Clinton's terminology. It takes a village. My husband is fond of saying it takes a church, not a village. But in our churches and in our larger communities, we really do need to depend on one another and support each other with our gifts and talents and strengths. So on your handout for today, I have left plenty of space for you to list local sources of meat, dairy, produce, grains, anything else you can think of that you will need. It's going to take you some time to develop these sources. So I'm not going to have you filling it in today, of course, but you're going to get in your car and you're going to take the kids and you're going to go exploring. And down at the bottom of the page, you visit the websites that are listed there and make phone calls. There will be real people that are represented on these websites. I've been calling because we recently moved here to Minnesota. And you just talk to them and become their friends and ask for their help. Pay them fairly, but you'll be surprised how many little blessings will be thrown in along the way, things you never expected, and you'll make some of the best friends of your life by doing this. Now, maybe you're like me and you really like to bake, okay? That's something I enjoy, but gardening is not my thing. I don't know anything about it. So maybe I can bless others with healthy breads and grains, and I can get eggs or milk or produce in return. So on your handout, on the right side of the page, only list things that you can do yourself. If you love those things enough to consistently carve out time to perfect your skills and improve week by week, because if it becomes a drudgery to you, you're going to have huge motivation to go back to McDonald's or Hamburger Helper. And by all means, develop a relationship instead with someone who lives locally and can help you in those areas. Okay, that was a whirlwind for page 1. Let's go on to page 2 of our handout, and that tells us that we should not only eat locally, we need to eat wisely. Now, this is not so much of an action step as it is a mental step. It's a new way of looking at your food. It's a paradigm shift, if you will. So I don't even count this in my action step for today. This is just a new way of thinking. There are 4 principles on this page that are going to help you develop a heart of wisdom in your eating. And first, on the top of the page, you see the Sabbath principle. Now, this principle recognizes that our Creator God designed our calendar, and He has set aside times of rest and times of work for us. And if we will be careful to rest when he says to rest and work when he says to work, he'll begin to move in amazing ways in our lives to provide healthful food for us. Would you be willing, we're not going to read all of the verses on the sheet, but Kathy, could you read for me from Psalm 90, verse 12?
Sure. Okay, Psalms 90, verse 12 says, "So teach us to number our days, that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom."
All right, so we need to learn to number our days so that we can gain his wisdom. How many days a week does God say in the Bible that we should work? Do you know, Kathy?
Well, I just he tells us to work 6 days, and we should rest on one day, on the seventh. So
good. Okay, and that comes from Exodus chapter 20. It's the first section on your handout. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. Very good. You did it. So that means we have to develop a mindset of working. You know, sometimes we get the feeling that we're overworked and we're working our fingers to the bone because we have to work 6 days a week. God's word doesn't have a 40-hour work week in it. He doesn't say anything about work 5 days and get 2 days off each weekend and you get 3-day holidays here and there. I mean, he does have his holidays, but generally speaking, he tells us to work for 6 days a week. He also tells us to rest 1 day each week. So next week, I'm going to be giving you some practical time management tools that will help you learn how to cook healthy food at home in your own kitchen. But those time management tools are based on the fact that we need to work for 6 days and rest for one. Now, resting for 1 day each week requires that I plan ahead. I'm not very good at that. On a resting day, I should not be cooking and working in the kitchen. Rather, I should plan ahead and make extra food the day before my Sabbath. Now, God told the children of Israel to gather extra manna the day before their Sabbath, and that's from Exodus 16. But some of the people didn't do that. They went out on Sabbath morning to gather manna, and lo and behold, there was no manna. And God had said, plan ahead. Now, the same principle applied to the land of Israel. They were told to let their fields lie fallow every seventh year. Don't plant anything. Let them rest. God promised he would supply extra food the sixth year so that they could set some aside and plan ahead. So we see that this principle of planning ahead for times when we know we're going to need to rest is from God. Maybe a mom knows she's going to have a baby, and she has 9 months to plan ahead and prepare meals for the freezer and be ready for the rest time she knows she's going to need. We all know that times are busy. I'm in the middle of an 8-week health class, and I know I'm going to be busy. It has been phenomenally busy, but very fun. But I had to plan ahead to make it through, or we would have been buying pizza every night, I tell you. So what can we do to plan ahead for busy times that we know are going to come? Even more so, what can we do each week on the sixth day to plan ahead for a day of complete rest, recuperation, a day when we're out of the kitchen and not working? However, on the other 6 days, we shouldn't be grumbling about being in the kitchen working because God tells us to work 6 days a week, and we need to develop a really good attitude about working and that, so that we're working without complaining and constantly feeling sorry for ourselves. Okay, the second principle is the manna principle. Now, again, the children of Israel were told by God to save ahead manna for the seventh day. Now, one person, it tells us, attempted to save ahead some manna on the other days, too. You know, I can just picture it. He thought he could capitalize on this new fast food market, manna fast food, manna McDonald's, whatever, making Israel's first processed packaged food. After all, I mean, they're going to be out there in the wilderness for a long time. It's going to get old making manna, right? So why not gather in large quantities and package it up for the women who'd rather do anything but have to be stuck in the kitchen making another meal of manna for their families? Unfortunately, this young entrepreneur found out that the next morning his manna was stinking and rotting and crawling with worms. So God had no tolerance for the packaged food business. I would really love it if you could write this in your notes. Write down, eat only food that will spoil and eat it before it does. I'm going to say that again. Eat only food that will spoil and eat it before it does. And this is the manna principle. God provides our daily bread. Processed food is inexpensive for food giants to produce, but think about it. It sells well because it takes advantage of our natural fears. Like, what if? What if tomorrow I don't have any food? What if there's a depression? Maybe I should stock up. Or what if I'm too busy to ever cook again? Or what if I hate to cook? And what if this? And what if that? And we're constantly fearing the future. Rather, God says, simply work. Work 6 days a week. Be diligent in your work. And he will provide for tomorrow. And we can trust him. And I have some verses there if you'd like to meditate on that some more at home this week. Good food rots. Processed food does not rot. It has an incredibly long shelf life, and it's basically indestructible. That's why they take it in the military. However, it does not provide us with nutrition that we need. God's food will rot, and it does not lend itself to mass marketing. And that's why you have to find your food locally. Good food doesn't generally ship around the world very well because it rots before it gets there. But good food strengthens your cells. It enhances your digestion. It gives you strength to serve God and your family. Again, a lot of verses are on your handout, and I encourage you to find some quiet time with God this week to open up your Bible and read through these verses and meditate on the questions that are there and ask him to show you what his will is for those. Okay, the third principle there is the seasons principle. This principle comes from the book of Ecclesiastes, where we learn to everything there is a season and a time to every purpose under the heaven, a time to plant and a time to pluck up that which is planted. And that comes from Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 3. When Noah came off the ark, God told him something very important. I was wondering, Kathy, if you would read for us from Genesis chapter 8, verse 22.
Okay, sure. Genesis 8, 22 says, "While the earth remaineth, seed time in harvest, and cold and heat, and summer and winter, and day and night, shall not cease."
Wow. You hearing what that says? Seasons don't change, God says. No matter what we hear about global warming or other environmental disasters, that comes from an evolutionary mindset. God has decreed seasons, and seasons will not change. So I know winter is coming, and it's going to be more difficult to get my food locally at that time of year, especially produce. So what should I do in the spring and the summer and the fall? I need to be working 6 days a week and setting aside food for the winter that I know is going to come. God's word says so. We've gotten into such a supermarket mindset that we think we're above seasons. Now seasons are nothing more than an inconvenience or maybe a playtime if you like to go skiing. But God decrees that seasons will continue as long as the earth remains. Would you mind reading for us from Proverbs chapter 3, verses 6 through 11?
Sure. Sure. He talks about the ant here, which when you was talking about the up there about preparing for the winter, immediately the thought of the ant came to mind.
Good.
Yeah. So it says, "Go to the ant, you sluggard. Consider its ways and be wise. It has no commander, no overseer or ruler. Yet it stores its provisions in summer and gathers its food at harvest. How long will you lie there, you sluggard? When will you get up from your sleep, a little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest, and poverty will come on you like a bandit, and scarcity like an armed man."
Aren't those great verses?
Mm.
They really
yeah.
are. Oh. I love that word, sluggard. That's just such a picture to it.
Mm-hmm.
The seasons yeah. principle, it says that God delights in supplying our needs. He does. But our part is to put away our laziness and stop being a sluggard. So,
wow.
All right. The final principle is the ancient principle. And this one is so needed in our culture. What is the common attitude toward elderly people in our culture? That tells us everything right there. We think of them as dumb, as a nuisance, in the way, slow and old. We're wise in our own eyes. That's what God says. We're wise in our own eyes, and we think our culture is the smartest and the best. But the reality is we should be humble and learn from those who have come before us. Again, I am convinced that Noah and his family would not have survived if they hadn't brought the wisdom of the ancient people who lived before the flood with them to their new world. We have such a rich heritage, and we're blessed to live in a day and time when we, just common, ordinary people, can access that heritage by the internet, learning from researchers and explorers and archaeologists who have documented these things for us through books and seminars and classes, and we need to learn. Science and technology are just simply tools But as Job says, with the ancient is wisdom. And that was our verse from the beginning. Mm-hmm. I would love to tell you about an amazing man. He's a hero of mine. His name is Dr. Weston Price. He was born in 1870 and he died in 1948. He was a Cleveland dentist, and he was called the Charles Darwin of nutrition. So, yes, sadly, this man believed in evolution. I wish he could have been a believer in Jesus Christ, because it would have revolutionized his research. And if you read his book, you will certainly see the evidence of his evolutionary belief system coming out. But I'm going to read to you just a little bit. There's an organization named after him, the Weston Price Organization, and they've written about him, and it says, in his search for the causes of dental decay and physical degeneration that he observed in his dental practice, he turned from test tubes and microscopes to unstudied evidence among human beings. Dr. Price sought the factors responsible for fine teeth among the people who had them, and he found them among isolated primitives, okay? That's what he calls them in his book, primitives. And the world became his laboratory. As he traveled, his findings led him to the belief that dental caries and deformed dental arches resulted in crowded, crooked teeth and unattractive appearance, and that these were merely a sign of physical degeneration resulting from what he had suspected, nutritional deficiencies. So Price got his wife, and he traveled the entire world over, and his book is just amazing as he tells of his travels. And he studied isolated human groups. Some of the places he went to were Switzerland. He went to Gaelic communities in the Outer Hebrides, Eskimo and Indians of North America, I don't even know if I can pronounce all these, Melanesian and Polynesian South Sea Islanders, African tribes, Australian Aborigines, New Zealand Maori, and the Indians of South America. So he was so thorough. He went worldwide. And wherever he went, Dr. Price found that beautiful straight teeth with freedom from decay, strong bodies, resistance to disease, and fine character were typical of primitives that were living on traditional diets that were rich in essential food factors. When Dr. Price then analyzed the foods in laboratories that were used by the isolated primitive peoples, he found he found that the food provided four times the calcium and other minerals and at least 10 times the fat-soluble vitamins from animal foods such as butter and fish eggs. The importance of good nutrition for mothers during pregnancy has long been recognized, but Dr. Price's investigation showed that primitives understood and practiced preconception nutritional programs for both parents. This is amazing to me. Many tribes required a period of premarital nutrition. They brought them all these special foods that they had to eat before they were allowed to get married, and this assured subsequent offspring of physical excellence. Special foods were often given to pregnant and lactating women, as well as to maturing boys and girls in preparation for future parenthood. Dr. Price found these foods to be very rich in fat-soluble vitamins A and D, nutrients that are found only in animal fats. These primitives, with their fine bodies, their strong reproduction, their emotional stability, and freedom from degenerative diseases, stands forth in sharp contrast to the other cultures he looked at that were living on the impoverished foods of modern civilization, such as sugar and white flour, pasteurized milk, and convenience foods. And the photographs of Dr. Weston Price, because he took many photographs during his travels, they illustrate the difference in facial structure between those that lived on native diets and those whose parents had adopted civilized diets of processed foods.
Wow.
And I have provided just a few of these photographs in your handout, but if you'd like to read his amazing journal of his travels around the world, you could do so. You can purchase his book, which will support a very good cause, or you can read it free of charge online. It's really fun. And you'll find a link to these at anneshealthplace.com, and that's in your homework this week. Obviously, I'm not expecting, it's like 900 pages. You probably wouldn't get that done in your homework. So I also have been privileged to travel to some of the places that he went to, or I've read about them in the travels of my extended family, or I've learned from missionaries with whom I'm acquainted. For instance, I've seen firsthand the devastation that has come upon the Navajo Indian tribe in Arizona. Our family lived there for 3 years. And when white people, just relatively recently, brought their newfangled foods to the Navajo people, the rates of diabetes and heart disease began to skyrocket, and now there are medical clinics everywhere. They can't figure out what's wrong. These people were so strong just 50 years ago. And I taught childbirth education classes to the daughters of these people, and I've had to help them learn how to eat good food again and to return to their traditional diets. And I've seen how urgently important it is for them to do so if the Navajo people will be not wiped out, basically, from our world. It's just devastation there. Now, I really enjoy reading in Weston Price's book about the people of Switzerland. I don't have a Swiss heritage, but I guess I read Heidi too many times with my kids, and I feel at home in, when I get to that part of Weston Price's journal. And one thing that stood out to me again is that these women did not try to do it all themselves. They lived in community with one another, and one woman's talent for bread baking or cheese making would contribute to the entire community. It sounds like a wonderful way to live, because, Kathy, I'm not a superwoman, and I cannot do it all myself. No, but we're such independent Americans. We've bred it within ourselves that it's righteous to do it all. We can pull ourselves up by our bootstraps.
Oh, Anne, but we can't.
No,
you know,
no.
If you don't mind, when I saw these pictures on the handout, I just couldn't believe it. It reminded me so, we, this weekend, had stayed at Garden Valley, Texas at Mercy Ships and at their headquarters. And I honestly had heard much about Mercy Ships before, but they actually have a huge ship that docks at third world countries for like 10 months to a year at a time. And the people, they screen them, but they can come on ship and receive medical care, and lots of them receive lots of surgery. And also they have trained staff that go off the ships and actually out into with the natives, and they help them with their food and with their animals and such. And I was wandering on this campus this weekend and on some of the trails, and I came upon their agricultural site, and they have a training site there where they actually train the people to go on the ships. And they also bring people over from other countries to train them right there on the grounds. But
wow.
I thought of you immediately, Anne, because they had lambs and sheep that were out grazing in the open pastures. And they had the cattle that were out in the open pastures, and they were telling me, you know, yes, they're organic, and yes, they're grass-fed. I'm thinking, yum, yum, yum. And then they also had this barn. It was wonderful. A lady took us on this tour. But they had a barn that had chickens in, and the chickens could freely go outside, and it smelled so wonderful. She had the doors wide open, and the fresh air was coming in. And then you're going to love this. Then she had this pet bunny. She had some rabbits there, too. And this pet bunny, she actually took it outside. We put it on a leash, put it right by a tree so that it's just so that it could eat green clover. And it was so fun to watch the rabbit. He was just eating that green clover, you know, it was so cute. It's like, oh, this is perfect. This is what Anne's been talking about. And then she showed me her garden. And the big garden was, it had grass everywhere. It was bare. And she said, yes, this is the year to let it rest. She said, as the Sabbath rests. I'm like, yes, we're talking
wow.
about that too. So
good,
it was so cool.
Them.
Yeah, to see they were letting it rest. And then they had a small, I'm sorry, I'm talking, so I'm so excited.
Yeah, you're fine.
But then they had this small garden that they hadn't, that they were using in the meantime, that they actually had broccoli growing, and they had some other things planted and such. But anyway, it was such, you know, when I saw those pictures, I thought, oh, Mercy Ships. That reminded me of our stay this weekend and what they're doing there. And it's so, I was so thrilled to see that they were teaching them how to do it organically and how to do it, you know, what's best for them to get those. And they actually aren't trying to change them. They go to the third world countries, and they actually, you know, adapt to their cultures there and work within their culture. So that exactly what you're just talking about. So anyway, it's just exciting to know that the value of that, the extreme
yeah.
value of having foods, you know, locally that are part of our heritage and grown and all those things.
Once you experience it, it's really difficult to go back to a supermarket again.
It's
just, you know, the personality of someone that is in contact with God's creation day after day, their personality even calms down and slows down and changes, and there's a peace to it. And boy, get me going on that one.
Yeah, the lady that gave us a tour, she was an elderly lady, and she had retired and had just walked away from her life and joined Mercy Ships, and they had had her be a part of the farm, and she just loves it. She wasn't really raised on a farm, but she absolutely loves it, and you could tell it. But anyway, so
that leads let me
share that.
No, that's such neat timing that God allowed you to see that this week, so you could share it with
mm-hmm.
us. I think that leads really well into page three, because that's what I want to impress on everyone on page three. The final step for our food preparation is eat slow. Just say, and relax and slow down and take the stress out of your life. Food preparation does not have to be hard. It just needs to be slow. And again, this takes a new way of looking at your kitchen. And the only thing hard about this method is that I have to change the way I think. And that can be really hard. I promise. I'm not going to lie to you. But the food preparation itself is easy. As we read in class one of our series, I love the verse, Acts 14:17, God left not himself without witness, and that he did good and gave us rain from heaven and fruitful seasons. And why? To fill our hearts with food and gladness. That tells me so much about God's character. So let's talk about some practical ways to think slow food. Okay, first of all, we have slow growing, just exactly what you experienced this weekend, Kathy. Mm-hmm. Growing food takes a season, and a season is much slower than a trip to the grocery store. And this means that all of you that are listening might not be able to change your diet to something ideal overnight. There might not be a quick fix. But it's great that we're recording these classes in February. A new growing season is just beginning here in the United States. It's the perfect time for you to begin to learn what is in season. I've got some books listed in your homework that would be great additions to your home library. But you could also just use Google and on the internet and find out what's in season for your area. And use this information to start to think about what you could eat at each season. What foods would be highest in nutrition in June, per se, and what foods need to be stored away for January. How are you going to store them? And how are you going to rework your food budget so that you're able to do that? Maybe you're going to use an income tax refund the first time to get you started, and then learn to set aside a little cash each payday for the following seasons. Just some ideas. But slow growing. Okay, next is slow harvesting. You know, harvesting used to be a much slower affair than it is today. When the sheaves of wheat were gathered into piles out in the fields, the seeds inside the stacks would maybe get a little bit damp and a little warm in the autumn sun, and within a few days, many of the stalks would have started to sprout, and that would deactivate the enzyme inhibitors that we've discussed in previous weeks, and it would multiply the nutritional benefits of the wheat. However, today, our modern farm equipment has the wheat off the stalk and to the food producer so quickly that nothing has time to sit in the warm sun and sprout, and we lose so much nutrition just by our speed. Now, unless you have a farm, you probably can't do much about the methods of harvesting, but you can buy organically grown wheat that has not been irradiated, and you can sprout the seeds at home in a mason jar by your kitchen sink. And this sprouted wheat can then be carefully dried out and ground into an amazing flour that is easy to digest and is packed with nutrition, not to mention its delicious taste. Other things can be sprouted as well, such as beans and seeds, and this is such an easy way to add enzymes and nutrition to our diet. Sprouts can be added to salads, and that's one of their most common uses, but what about adding them to breads and muffins or even juices? So yes.
Sorry, Anne, I didn't mean
no,
to
go ahead.
But you're talking about sprouting wheat, and I do have some wheat here that I'm just getting ready to grind for my first time. And I know you've talked me through the process of sprouting, but honestly, I've forgotten. Can you walk me through that?
Sure. Sure. It's really easy. You don't need a recipe. Basically, if you have a clean mason jar, or that works really well. That's what I use. It's just a clean mason jar, and fill it maybe a third full of wheat, the seeds of wheat kernels. And you don't want to fill it too full because they're going to expand. And you're going to put some fresh water in there. You don't want to use water that has chlorine in it that could kill the enzymes. Just some good filtered water. Fill it up and put I have a special sprouting lid that I purchased for a couple dollars, but you could just use a piece of dish towel and a rubber band to put something over the top and let the air flow. And tip that thing over. Oh, I'm sorry. Let it soak overnight and then get that wheat nice and wet, and it's warm in your kitchen. And then the next morning, tip it over, and it's going to rinse that water out. And now the warm is going to combine with the wet, and it's just going to, it takes 2 or 3 days, and you'll see little sprouts growing. And I tend to rinse mine off every, you know, a couple times a day and kind of hurry it along a little bit, but after I'm talking about slow, but it doesn't take any time at all, and you'll see the little sprouts just coming out. And as soon as you see those sprouts, you know that the enzymes have been deactivated. You don't have to go any further than that. You can stop right there. And then I spread mine on a cookie sheet, and I put it in a very, very low temperature oven, an oven that's not going to kill enzymes, of course, just the lowest temperature I have, and maybe crack the door open a little bit. And I stick it, all that wet wheat out on a cookie sheet, leave it in there for a day or so until it's crispy again, and I can put it through my grain mill. And then I just use it as I would any flour. And it's great because it's already been deactivated. I don't have to soak or sourdough anything. So it's great for muffins and cookies and all of those quick breads. It's just a perfect flour for those. Okay. Did that explain a little better?
Yeah.
It really is easy. It really is.
It's like a science experiment.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So the morning after you soaked it overnight, you just tip it over and you drain it out.
Yeah.
And then couple times during the day, you can just rinse it. You don't leave water in there anymore.
No, I don't leave water. It's, as you remember, it's not. It's a very forgiving method. If you've got a busy day, it doesn't hurt it. It's just going to sit there and do its thing. It's kind of like growing a house plant. It's very easy.
All righty. Well, I'm gonna give it my best shot.
Okay.
Ask me about it next week.
I will. Okay. All right. Now, the next thing on your list is slow preservation. We have been conditioned to think that garden produce has to be canned or refrigerated or if it's going to make it through a winter. But think about this. What did they do before refrigeration? Refrigeration is incredibly new. Have we somehow evolved to be better and smarter again than our ancestors, or did we just invent a tool of convenience that is robbing us of the wisdom of the ancient people? Now, I'd like to introduce you to a word. I've been telling you about it, but it's called lactofermentation, and it sounds a little gross, but it's just a highly technical word for something that Noah's wife knew how to do. In the fabulous book, Nourishing Traditions, I hope you all have this book on your bookshelf, and author Sally Fallon writes about lactofermentation. I'm just going to quote her because she did such a good job of explaining it. She says, "Lactic acid is a natural preservative that inhibits bacteria. Starches and sugars in vegetables and plants are converted into lactic acid by the many species of lactic acid-producing bacteria that naturally live in our food. These lactobacilli are everywhere. They're present on the surface of all living things and especially numerous on the leaves and roots of plants that grow in or near the ground." Boy, doesn't that sound like Genesis?
Mm-hmm.
Man needs only to learn the techniques for controlling and encouraging their growth to put them to his own use, just as we have learned to take certain yeasts and put them to use in converting sugars and grape juice to alcohol and wine. And this reminds me of when God told us to take dominion over the earth. And he put it all there. We just have to put it to use. And I'll keep reading from her. "Like the fermentation of dairy products into things like yogurt, we all know about that one, the preservation of vegetables and fruits by the process of lactofermentation has numerous advantages beyond those of simply preserving our food. The proliferation of lactobacilli in fermented vegetables enhances their digestibility and increases vitamin levels. These beneficial organisms produce numerous helpful enzymes as well as antibiotic and anti-carcinogenic substances. Their main byproduct, lactic acid, not only keeps vegetables and fruits in a state of perfect preservation, but also promotes the growth of healthy flora throughout the intestines." So these are just fabulous foods, wonder foods, super foods, I think is what she uses, is the word in her book. Some examples of these that you're going to recognize right away: sauerkraut, cucumbers, beets and turnips, pickled herbs. Some people in some cultures will take sorrel leaves and grape leaves and they'll pickle them. Pickled green tomatoes, preserves like jams and fruit preserves, peppers, lettuces. If you go over to Eastern countries, you have kimchi. I had a friend that used to eat kimchi all the time. Relishes, chutneys. Those are words that we can understand. Now I'm making more sense. Not some lactofermentation word, but pickles. I can understand pickles. The difference is instead of canning them under high heat and preserving them with just vinegar, we are allowing the actual bacteria that God put in them to preserve them for us. Now, these are so easy to make, and this is the basic idea. What someone does is they would wash up the vegetable and cut it up, mix it with salt and herbs and spices. They might pound it briefly with a little pounder, or I just use a wooden spoon and just release some juices out of them, and that's going to get the lactic acid started. And you're going to press it down into an airtight container. A mason jar works great. And you put some salt in to inhibit bacteria for a few days until the lactic acid starts to being produced enough that it will preserve your vegetables. And that lactic acid is going to preserve those vegetables for many, many months. So that's how you can get through a winter. And some cultures would add whey in instead of the salt. And I've done that as well. Whey is just a natural byproduct of yogurt or cheese making, and it's super easy to use. And vegetables that can be kept at room temperature for the first few days so that the warmth in your house starts to get them fermenting, but then you store them down in a cool, dark place for long term, such as a root cellar that everyone used to have. You can even buy starters for this for us newbies that are just getting started. These are simply natural cultures that have been freeze-dried. They're perfectly healthy, and this is a great place for beginners to start. You can find out what you like and what you don't like. You might not even have a garden or have anything else to, you know, any of the other resources, no whey and the salt and stuff. But anyway, you can start with these box starters, and you can find links to these on my website this week. Now, slow preservation, it does not destroy enzymes like the heat of canning would. And the taste satisfies. It's such a good, crisp taste. I think, Kathy, did I ever give you a bite of some sauerkraut that's been lacto-fermented?
Yes, it was yummy, yes.
It's amazing. It bears no resemblance to that mushy stuff that's in a can. Bubbies. Bubbies sauerkraut.
Bubbies.
Let's give them a hand. They're fabulous. A great company. I love to support Bubbies. And that craving that satisfies is we crave foods and we meet them instead with MSG. That's how most of our cravings are met. But they're not supposed to be that way. Those cravings are telling us that we need some good lacto-fermented foods in our diet. And every family will probably have their own favorite taste techniques, and your creativity really comes out as you perfect the recipes. It is so much fun. We have had a lot of fun in our kitchen doing these. We've made a lot of mistakes. We've opened up some jars after a few months and taken a bite and said, no, I don't think we'll try that one again. And we've laughed. And honestly, though, when you actually get one to turn out, it is one of the most satisfying things you could ever do. It is very, very fun and very delicious. And just a little bite of this on your plate at mealtime, it increases the nutrition that you're eating by hundredfold. This brings me to the slow enzymes on your handout. I guess I'm getting the reputation that enzymes is like my middle name. But as we ferment foods at home on our countertops and as we add raw foods to our diet, we dramatically increase the enzyme content of our foods. And as we've learned before, that takes so much stress off of our own bodies and allows our bodies to heal. Now, enzymes are naturally present in vinegars and wines, and these can be used as brines and marinating liquids in our kitchen. You can use them on salads and vegetables. You can tenderize your meat with them. Another source of enzymes would be raw honey that you would spread on your bread, or you can make a simple condiment such as mustard and mayonnaise and ketchup and salsa. Those are so easy, and homemade salsa is to die for. And these can be made quickly before any meal. Or if you want to think ahead a little, you can ferment the salsa on your countertop for a week or so that now it's ready in your cupboard shelves for whenever you need it, and you've increased the enzyme content dramatically. Now think about an American hamburger for a second, okay? If it's made with grass-fed beef and you put it on this properly prepared, delicious bun, and you smother it in enzyme-rich homemade mustard and ketchup and mayonnaise, and you top it with lacto-fermented dill pickles, you have the perfect food, Kathy. Your husband would kiss you. Yeah. It just he'll never, ever go back.
It's grilling ahead, yes.
A summer salad can be full of enzymes, but if you top a salad with homemade dressing that's also full of enzymes from fermented vinegars and wines and oils. Cold-pressed oils have all of their enzymes in them, or maybe some buttermilk. And you now have an amazing health food, and it tastes way better than any bottle of Kraft salad dressing. And honestly, Kathy, it just takes like 30 seconds to make this. It is so fast. It's amazing. And again, the taste is very satisfying to our bodies, and we notice that the hunger pains go away. These can all be prepared very quickly at dinner time. But notice that the homemaker had to think ahead. She had to prepare her food slowly on her countertop. It's not hard. It's just slow, okay? Now,
okay.
Like Heidi, she's up in the Swiss Alps, okay? I think if you remember, she had the food that she ate with her grandfather. A healthy lunch can consist of sourdough bread. That's one of the things she ate. And it's one of the healthiest and easiest types of bread to make, but it's also one of the slowest because sourdough bread consists of nothing, okay? Get this. It has flour and water and salt. What could be easier?
Wow.
You don't have to have a fancy mixer for it because it's one of the easiest breads to knead by hand, and it feels so good to do it. It's not hard. It doesn't make a mess. However, a good sourdough bread, one that doesn't have any added yeast in it, that are just there to speed up the process artificially, if you make it the real way, the old-fashioned way, it takes time. It requires more hours. It just sits on your counter, and it does your work for you, but you have to think ahead. Now, the taste is heavenly. You will never, ever go back to Wonder Bread again. And I have some starters, not my own, but some companies that I recommend for some fabulous sourdough starters, and these companies also provide recipes and a lot of support in helping you learn how to do it. But honestly, nothing is easier than sourdough bread. It is so easy and so delicious. You could smear homemade butter, and homemade butter would still contain its enzymes from if you got it from raw milk and its nutrients from its grass-fed mother. And you can spread this on your sourdough bread with a little raw honey. And now you can digest all the nutrition in your food easily. You don't have to worry about whether there's fat-soluble vitamins or minerals. You don't have to care. Everything is in one package, and it's there. And you could add in a hunk of raw cheese, and that is so satisfying in just a few bites. You don't have to eat a lot of raw cheese because it has a sharper taste, and just a few bites does the trick. But it has a very high enzyme content. And then you drink a fermented drink such as cultured buttermilk. That's what Heidi did in the book. And your lunch is perfect. And it's easy. You could take it along with you in the car on a busy day. It's kid-friendly and doesn't fill the backseat with French fries. It's very inexpensive. And its only downside is that it's slow. And you have to plan ahead. It's not hard, just slow. So what about slow cooking, okay? Not all foods should be raw. Some foods, such as cabbage and broccoli, potatoes, they are so fibrous that they are very difficult to digest. And we have been brainwashed into thinking we have to sit and crunch and munch our way through these foods. If you would cook such foods, it makes their nutrients more available to you. Vegetables and fruits often contain chemicals that block the production of thyroid hormones, for instance, or they block calcium and iron absorption, or they irritate the intestinal tract. They disrupt the formation of red blood cells. So cooking or fermenting, both of which are good, those things destroy those harmful substances. And it may sound like heresy, but some foods should simply be cooked. Now, it's only if we believe in evolution that we will say that man didn't invent fire until recently in our history and that all foods were consumed raw before that and they kind of tore it off with their fangs, you know, off the bones. And we know this is not true because in God's word, the first fire is mentioned at the sacrifice that Adam and Eve gave at the end of the third chapter of Genesis. So they obviously knew what fire was. Mm-hmm. However, cooking is best done slowly, getting a picture here. Soup is an excellent example of this. When animal bones are slowly simmered on the back of your stove for many hours, their bones release minerals and gelatin that helps us digest the vegetables that we're going to add to the pot, and it smells so good. Other vegetables could be lightly steamed right before dinner, and that maintains a lot of their enzyme content, but it begins to break down the difficult-to-digest cellular walls of the vegetables. And you smother them in butter, put some herbs and spices that are fresh and full of enzymes, and you just pull it off of a pot on your windowsill. And you can now absorb all the fat-soluble vitamins that the vegetables contain. Baking, roasting, slow cookers, crock pots, these are all excellent and slow methods of food preparation, both for vegetables and fruits and for meats. So think slow, and you're going to be on target every single time. Now, slow requires that I think ahead. I have to plan for supper at breakfast time or maybe even the day before. But when mealtime comes, nothing's faster because my supper is basically ready to go. I open the lid and pull it out. So it's very easy. Rice and beans, those should be soaked and slowly cooked. to deactivate enzyme inhibitors. I plan on an entire afternoon for my rice, and I could probably do longer than that. Beans I take a good 24 hours to cook, and they're delicious, though, and very inexpensive. Quick breads, they should be turned into slow quick breads. Soak the flour overnight. Everyone should be proud of Kathy. She had some muffins earlier today and went to the extra step of soaking them first. Nuts should be soaked before you eat them and then made crispy again, maybe in a warm oven or out in the sunshine in the summertime. And that way you can digest the nuts properly. Again, none of these methods are hard. They're just slow. Yes, Kathy. Sorry.
No, that's okay. Like with my oatmeal, I soaked it. It was a cup of oatmeal, so I soaked it in a cup of milk. But like for my bread that I'm going to be making in the near future, is it an equal amount of liquid? No, okay.
I'm going to make a note here to send you to a website. I will add it to my website this afternoon. Bread is one of the hardest things, and I'll tell you why. Bread is temperamental. It reacts to the environment of your kitchen, and if your kitchen is a little bit drier or a little bit more humid than my kitchen, then the recipe is different, and you have to get used to the feel of bread. And that's why I highly recommend going with sourdough first, because sourdough is fermented in a different way. It's fermented with the cultures that are inside the sourdough, and so it's not so picky. But when you soak breads, it requires a little bit of practice to get used to what it should feel like. And I can send you to some websites that have videos that you can watch, and they explain how to do that. It's not hard. It just takes a little bit of practice to kind of find out the consistency, as it is a little different than oatmeal or beans or rice would be. That's not a very good answer, is it? But I can send you to some videos, and they can help you out. But once you get it down, once you've done it a couple times and had some success, it's very easy. I botched up a batch of bread this last Friday. I was trying to get ready for resting, and it must have been more humid in my house because my bread was just an absolute mess. So we didn't have bread that weekend. So I've been making bread for a while now, so that everybody, it just depends on a lot on the weather. And that was a very good question. Next week, we're going to cover a lot of methods and equipment. We're going to talk about budgeting your money and your time, most importantly your time, because I think that's the hardest part. But for today, just to get your brain thinking about looking at all the food around you and thinking, now how would I take that boxed mix and how would I make it slowly at home, okay? How about slow drinks? That's something we haven't really talked much about yet. Soft drinks, they have taken over our society. We can't walk around without a can of Diet Coke in our hands, or we don't know what else to drink. And now they have vitamin waters, and they're kindly enriched with neurotoxins so that we can really poison our brains. Mm-hmm. But in ancient times, people drank lacto-fermented drinks, and I thought this was so weird when I heard about it first. But my family's favorite, you probably never heard of it, it's called kombucha. I love it, but it's made slowly over a week, and you put it in a glass bowl out on your kitchen counter. You can talk to it like a houseplant. You can find and it tastes wonderful. My children love it. It's bubbly like pop would be. You can find bottled kombucha at a local health food store if you'd like to try it sometime and see if you like the taste before you go to the trouble of making it at home. At my store, it's over $4 for a 16-ounce bottle. It's a premium health food, but it just cost me pennies to make it at home. You have to get a starter from someone else. You got to find somebody who's making kombucha, and they share. So it kind of goes back into the eat local principle. But this is an excellent place to start. You can go buy a really expensive 16-ounce bottle and guzzle it down and go, wow, now that's how soft drinks should taste. And other popular drinks are lacto-fermented ginger ale, root beer. All of these things were traditionally lacto-fermented. They were made with roots that were available locally to the people. Kefir sodas, these are super easy, and they're very delicious, and they've become really popular in just the past few years. Even since I've been making kombucha, all of a sudden kefir sodas are being talked about everywhere on the Internet. The book Nourishing Traditions describes the process of making a Russian lacto-fermented drink called kvass. You can make kvass from lots of different things. Some people make it with beets, but in the book it talks about how a Russian woman would make it from sourdough bread. So she would take 4 or 5 slices of the sourdough bread and she would put it in her warm oven until it would dried out, kind of making croutons out of it. And then she would bring a few quarts of water to boil and pour it over the bread. And then after it cooled, she'd add salt and whey, which she would have had available in her kitchen, and she'd cover it with a towel and leave it on her countertop for a couple days. And then she would take the bread out and add apples and raisins and then cover it tightly and store it in a cool, dark place for about a month. Now,
wow,
that's a lot of steps. And all of it had to happen before she could even take one sip of the stuff. Now, she would know her kvass was ready because the fruit would float to the top of the container, and that was a sign that it contained enough lactic acid. So it would tell her that it was ready, but obviously she was planning ahead and making enough jars of kvass for there to always be plenty year-round. But you can see it's not difficult, it's just slow. So that's just to give you a picture of what some of these drinks are like. It's a constant, all right, I got to get the next batch started, and constantly thinking ahead. And again, next week we are going to go into that in much more detail. Finally, we see that we need to enjoy our food slowly. Mealtime should be rest time. We should sit with our loved ones and put our work aside and thank our Heavenly Father for the food that He's provided, truly provided because of His amazing creation, and be thankful and relish each bite with delight and with gladness, as the Bible verse said. And we should enjoy each other's company, maybe mix in a little music or a good book in the evenings. And it just needs to be enjoyed.
Wow, that's a far cry from nowadays for most of us.
It is.
I know just traveling, we stop at a lot of, you know, drive-thrus and gulp our food down so we could keep going. And
yeah.
And even when I think at home, sometimes we're eating in front of the TV and not enjoying each other by any means, you know. So, wow, that is just so different than what, unfortunately, we kind of gravitated to.
Yeah, but it sounds nice, doesn't it?
It does sound nice.
Slow food. It's eating food that's prepared by loving hands. Eating food that remembers where it came from, grown by neighbors that we know and love, and what a difference just these simple things would make to our health. On page 4 of your handout, I've gone a little bit long, so I'm going to do this next section kind of quickly, but on page 4 of our handout, we've included a food diary of Sally Fallon, and she is the author of Nourishing Traditions. And this woman really practices what she preaches. She's not a believer in Jesus Christ, and she obviously enjoys meat from unclean animals. You can see the bacon and the sausage on that list. And I went through with a pen, and I just crossed off some of that bacon. I crossed off the lard, and I crossed off the sausages. And you could have easily substituted butter or coconut oil for some of those things. I make sausage from ground turkey here at home, and it tastes exactly the same. And so we do enjoy these foods. I just eat it from clean animals. But otherwise, this is an amazing food diary. Now, I drew a squiggly line under all the foods that were fermented or contained enzymes naturally. Let's point out some. At breakfast on day 1, she drinks raw milk and beet kvass, and they're both high in enzymes. For lunch, she eats raw cheese, and she washes it down with high-enzyme kombucha. For dinner, she gets loads of enzymes from her salad, the cold-pressed oils, the naturally brewed vinegars, the aged blue cheeses, and the sauerkraut. On day 2 at breakfast, she has raw honey, raw milk again, and more kvass. For lunch, her kombucha again provides enzymes. For dinner, she gets kombucha and more beet kvass plus sauerkraut to accompany her meat. On day 3, she gets fresh grapefruit with enzymes, plus her milk and kvass again. For lunch, she has aged feta cheese for enzymes and raw homemade butter. And again, check out her salad with oil and vinegar dressing and blue cheese and sauerkraut, kombucha and kvass. And then,
wow,
you know, take a pen and circle the grains that she properly prepared. For instance, on day 1, she eats properly prepared macadamia nuts for lunch. On breakfast, on day 2, she soaked her oatmeal. She had sprouted whole grain bread for lunch. On day 3, she made whole grain crackers at home, and that's a very easy recipe, very yummy. It's amazing, isn't it? Just to see how does someone eat like this. You can see a lot more food diaries online of some other people, not just hers, and it's a lot of fun. I thought hers was really cool. I prepared a healthy nutrition checklist that you can begin using to see how your diet compares with hers. Now, it might not look so good this week, but as you make changes, slow changes, you'll know exactly what you can do to continue to improve. And my checklist is based on foods that I like and I think are easy to prepare, but you might want to make your own checklist based on your own regional foods and favorite dishes. Okay, so eat local, eat wisely, eat slow. It's not hard, just slow. So that's the moral of today's story. Okay, after today's class, you do have homework to do. Visit annshealthplace.com to find today's handout and lots of reading assignments. These articles contain more information than we can ever fit into the show, and we've got lots of amazing information about the wonderful foods that God created and how you can begin to easily incorporate them into your diet. And these homework assignments are a fun place to start this week. In addition, on your website, you'll find a simple guide to eating slow foods. I provided lots of books and links to helpful websites and recipes, so be sure to download it right away. That is all for today. Next week's show is called Eating the Bread of Laziness. We're going to tackle all the difficult myths of health food. How can I afford healthy food? I don't have the right equipment in my kitchen, or I don't have time for all this, or how do I make a menu? I don't know where to start, or I will be the only weird person who ever eats like this, and how will I ever find good recipes? So next week is the most practical of all the class sessions, and now we've laid a very good foundation so you're going to understand why we're doing it and not just how. Kathy, thank you again for joining me.
Oh, what a pleasure, Ann. Wow, I am learning so much, and I can't wait to actually put it into practice more. So thank you
good.
So much. Yeah.
All right. Well, once again, this has been Ann Elliott from annshealthplace.com, and thank you so much for everyone for listening.